all of you, hopefully, are here for the session on PMS, perimenopause, and menopause. Just a slight housekeeping piece of business. For those of you sitting over here, I know I'm kind of angled this way, so if you want, if that's going to bother you, move over that way. There's a few seats. Or, you know, if you feel like you're missing it, flag me down. Am I in your way to see the screen? Okay. Well, I would like to welcome you to this session, and let's just start with a brief word of prayer. Dear Lord, thank you for each one of these ladies who we have been praying for who you would have to attend this session, and I ask that everything that's done and said today in this hour would bring honor and glory to you. In Jesus' name I pray. My name is Susan Smith. I am a nurse practitioner. Just a very brief background about myself. I did go to Bob Jones University. I have a Bachelor of Science degree in nursing. Immediately after graduation, I got married. I met my husband at Bob Jones, moved to Indianapolis, and enrolled in graduate school because that's what you do in my family. I didn't even know what a nurse practitioner was, and so it was divine intervention. I really believe God's will that I happened upon this particular career. And so I graduated within a few years with my Master of Science degree in nursing and even completed a few hours postgraduate at the time because I had no kids and nothing else to do and enjoy school. So that's no longer the case. I have two boys. One is in college and one is in eighth grade. My goals for you in this workshop, well, let me also say, I have worked in internal medicine for 21 years as a nurse practitioner, which is not a GYN specialty, but I have been the only woman doing women's health care there. And so I do most all of our women's exams, and this has just fallen to kind of my lot at my job to do. And I enjoy it, so it's been good. My goals for you in this workshop are that you will leave this room being able to define a little better. What is PMS? What does perimenopause mean? What is menopause? What are those things? How to know if you need to seek medical attention or not. Help you discriminate there. And hopefully give you some ideas for things you can do. I will ask you to excuse me. I have had bronchitis in February, and I am clearing my throat and coughing, and I have a huge bottle of water I'm going to drink this whole session, so if you'll just please excuse that, I would appreciate it. I want to start out by saying, when you see these three words, and let me just say that PMS is becoming a dated term. Do you know the new initials are PMDD, which is premenstrual dysphoric dysfunction, but I just felt like, for our purposes, most of us are familiar with PMS, and we're just going to leave it. when you think of these words, so don't even worry about that. When you think of these words, PMS or menopause, I'm a real picture person, so I'm going to use my hands a lot, and I have a lot of pictures, because maybe you'll hear words and see pictures, and it'll make more sense to you. But when you think of these words, I don't want you to think of three separate things on the shelf. I want you to think of a woven basket. And PMS is woven on top of perimenopause, and menopause is woven right into the basket along with them. Because they all have a similar basis, a similar process going on within our body that just happens to change a little bit as we go through the seasons. And so the symptoms are similar, the treatments are similar, and so I'm going to start kind of in chronological order and talk about PMS and then progress, but it's all applicable to each other. I hope that this woman does not live at your house. I think we all have felt maybe sort of like this sometimes. Just a very brief history. Do you know that there are documented symptoms of PMS in early Greek manuscripts? I find that fascinating. this is nothing new to women. This has been going on for a very long time. And the term premenstrual syndrome as a diagnosis actually wasn't official till 1953. That's just your little history trivia there. So what is a definition of PMS? PMS is a combination of emotional, physical, psychological, and mood disturbances. Don't you like that word, disturbances? That occur after ovulation and end with the onset of your menstrual cycle. Now, I'm going to give you a very brief medical lecture on what is ovulation and what our hormones are doing. This is not as, you know, if you want to read more about it, you can look it up. But I'm going to use my hands to give you a picture. But let's all picture our ovaries, which, do you know, they're the size of almonds. Is that amazing that two tiny little organs the size of almonds are giving us, causing all of you to sit in this room today? And they are connected by tubes called fallopian tubes to your uterus. Those little ovaries produce a hormone called estrogen. I call that hormone number one. It's like thing one and thing two. So here comes estrogen at the beginning of your cycle. So here's my first hormone level, and it starts out low. After when your period starts, the levels are low, and it gradually increases, usually about 2 weeks, 14 days, okay? So it increases, it increases, it increases, and it's stimulating your ovaries right to here where an egg matures because of the estrogen stimulation. And right here, that egg matures and is released from the ovary, and right where that little egg sac is, it produces progesterone. So now you have two hormones continuing to rise. So let me just review that so you understand. Estrogen rising to the midpoint, progesterone enters, and they keep raising. So why does that bother us? Why do we feel bad when that happens? You know, we're still studying that. We don't entirely know. There are some theories. One theory is that for some women, their brain tissue is more sensitive to elevated levels of hormones, and other women don't seem to be as sensitive, and that can cause some of the mood changes, some of the psychological disturbances, maybe the fatigue. There are people who, you've all heard of endorphins, the chemicals in our brain that make us feel good. There are some people who postulate that endorphin levels drop as the hormone levels get high, so that you don't feel as good. We know that there are physical changes that occur and that some women's bodies are more sensitive to elevated hormone levels. Let me give you a very concrete example of that. Most of you in this room have had a mammogram. How many, is there anyone here who has never had a mammogram? We'll talk about that after class. But if you have never asked what kind of breast tissue you have on your mammogram, after I tell you about this, you may feel free to ask your healthcare provider, what kind of breast tissue do I have? It always says on a mammogram. This is what you're born with. You are born with either fatty breasts, fibrous breasts, or a combination. It does not matter the size of your breasts. Very small breasts can be predominantly fatty. Very large breasts can be predominantly fibrous. Fatty tissue is very smooth. If you do a self-breast exam, you don't feel anything unless there's something there that doesn't belong. Fibrous tissue is very uneven. It's dense in spots. It's less dense in other spots. There may be fatty tissue mixed in with it, which just makes it feel all the more uneven. Fibrous tissue, we now know, very sensitive to elevated hormones. It is also sensitive to caffeine. So let's say you have a lot of fibrous tissue in your breasts. When your hormone levels get high, your breast may actually swell because they will retain water. They can be tender. Now let's say you're a big caffeine drinker. So let's say you're chugging along on your Starbucks, your hormones get high, your breasts are retain water from the caffeine and the hormones, you can be very, very uncomfortable. So we know that that is one physical symptom that we can document. Before I tell you all the symptoms, let me tell you there are over 153 documented physical symptoms and emotional symptoms for PMS. In the United States. In our country, 80% of all women will admit to some complaint related to PMS. 20 to 30% of all women will say it bothers them enough that they take Advil, go to bed early, use a heating pad, or even just say, I'm just really draggy, it's that time of the month. 2 to 6%, and that means 2 to 6 women out of every 100 have severe PMS, PMS that interferes with their ability to function. What are the physical symptoms of PMS? Well, obviously there's quite a few, but some of the most common are back pain, headaches, water retention, sleep changes, and that can be someone who needs more sleep and someone who can't sleep during that time of the month, who has insomnia. You can have a change in bowel habits. Some women have diarrhea during that time of the month and other women get constipated. You can have fatigue, breast tenderness, depression, all of these. Here's my favorite physical symptom, food cravings. Let me read this for if anyone has trouble. It says, welcome to the PMS diner. Our special today is Hershey bar lasagna that comes with M&M soup and mashed Snickers with hot fudge gravy. They have actually proven that there is a reason why we crave chocolate. The reason we crave chocolate is chocolate boosts the endorphins in our brain. And we know that in some people those endorphins go low, and so you crave something that will boost those levels back up. We also know that we can have fluctuating sugar levels during this time of the month. So to add something sweet and chocolate will often make us feel better. It will also make us gain weight. So you can't entirely blame all the weight you gain necessarily on pure PMS, because it may be the behaviors that you do to accommodate the PMS. Emotional symptoms include depression, sadness. When I say anger, I mean the person who's edgy, irritable, touchy, snappy. Some women actually say they can't focus as well. They have trouble at work or at home just focusing on what they need to do. I want to spend a few minutes on severe PMS, and I used a dark picture because severe PMS, if someone has that, and you may be here today on behalf of someone in your family or a friend or a neighbor who you feel has symptoms like this, this is a person who really needs to seek medical attention. This is a person who withdraws during that time of the month in an unhealthy way. They miss work days. They may even have thoughts of suicide, severe depression. They're not able to function. This is also a person who can have bouts of rage. You know, the best way I would explain that is like a road rage example. It might be at home, but they just erupt for very minor reasons that seem way out of proportion. Now, we all know our families think any edginess is way out of proportion, but this is truly out of proportion. And so this is a person who will, I have patients who will say, the truancy officer has been called to my house because I did not put my kids on the bus for 3 days because I couldn't get out of bed because of PMS. So that's not okay. And that needs some intervention. And the best thing you could do if that's you or someone else is to get some treatment for that and not be afraid to say, I'm really having a problem in this area. How do we make a diagnosis? This is the best way, I think, to make a diagnosis of PMS is to use a calendar. You need 3 months. You take your calendar. You might want to write down to the side all of your symptoms, whatever they are, headache, edginess. You draw, I'd use a nice red pen, draw a circle when your period starts each month, and then just write every day you have a symptom. Had a headache today, had constipation for 4 days here, was exhausted, had to take a nap. Then, and just don't worry about it, write them all down. At the end of 3 months, you want to look. What you should see, if your diagnosis is PMS, you should see a clustering of symptoms in the second half of the month. If instead you see bad headaches in the first week, really bad back pain the second week, really felt pretty good the third week, then you may have a different cause for your headaches, your fatigue, and that needs checked out too, because there may be some undiagnosed underlying problem that needs attention. Menstrual magnification. This means, and we know this is true, that you may have an underlying health condition such as a thyroid disorder, asthma, seizure disorder. This is very important. That can be worsened during the second half of your menstrual cycle. People who have a seizure disorder can have breakthrough seizures during the second half of the month. And what that really means, I mean, it depends on your healthcare provider, what they do. And I have done two different things. You may only need treatment during the second half of the month, depending on what your symptom is, or you may need increased treatment all the time in order to take care of that so you don't have breakthrough symptoms. So this would be another reason to document with a calendar what's going on so that it can help you adjust what kind of treatment you're taking. I want to talk just a little bit about management of symptoms, and I put a graph up here because to me the graph kind of shows a lot of things. It shows our hormones, that they go up, they go down on a monthly basis, and then other things can happen to us. We may have responsibilities that make us tired. We may drink caffeine and it can give us highs and lows. And then I also want to spend just a minute talking about the regulation of blood sugar levels. Blood sugar level regulation probably plays a big part in why a lot of women don't feel good. And girls, if I could, you know, if I could change anything about my life, it would be to get a handle on this early on, because it's gonna matter to us all, most all of us at some point, that we get a grip on the sugar in our life. So if you're not having to deal with it in your 20s, in your 60s, somebody's going to be telling you to clean up your diet, you know. So good discipline to start now. But let's just think a minute, what happens when you eat sugar, a lot of sugar? When I say sugar, my purposes aren't just for you to read labels. My purposes are obvious sugar. And I tell patients, cakes, cookies, pies, donuts, candy, ice cream. So, you know, if you put it on your plate and it says sugar, that's what I'm talking about. You don't have to read the spaghetti sauce label. Now, if you, for some other reason, want to do that, that's fine. But if you eat an obvious source of sugar, your pancreas, which puts out insulin, will put out a whole bunch of insulin because your sugar goes really high really fast. You feel good. Gives you a boost of energy, boosts your endorphins. So you can eat something sugary like a donut in the morning and feel really good for a short amount of time. Then that insulin comes out and takes care of that sugar. And if there was nothing behind it, no protein, no complex carbohydrates, the sugar drops right off. Well, so here you are. Your hormones are high. Maybe you drank a cup of coffee. You ate this donut. Your sugar went up. Your sugar went down. You feel crummy. You're lethargic. You're tired. So you eat something else. Maybe you run through Starbucks and you get something really good. And but then it's still short-lived. So you put yourself on a cycle like this. It's a bad roller coaster. And if you're wondering why you feel so bad, that would be one of the first things I would suggest you attempt to clean up. And it's so simple to just get rid of obvious sugar. That's just easier than reading labels and things like that. And for many people who drink a lot of liquid sugar, sweet tea, Cokes, that's an easy place to begin to make a change. And I have lots of ways you can make a change. You know, you could, if you are just addicted to Coke, maybe you could do half diet and half regular. It cuts your sugar a little. I'm not a huge proponent of lots of diet drinks, but, you know, we have to meet you where you are. And so that's one possibility. You could, I just tell patients, cut in half. Whatever you're doing, cut it in half to start with and see how you cope. You don't have to go live in a monastery and eat bread and water, but you need to make a positive change. If you eat ice cream every night before you go to bed, maybe make that a Saturday night treat or a Sunday night treat. So you don't have to give it up yet, but you have to improve it and see if that doesn't make you feel better. Decreasing your salty food may also make you feel better. It won't have the cycle like this, but we know that some women are prone to retain water when their hormones get high. They may feel like their rings are tight. They may just feel kind of bloated all over with water. And cutting out the salty food can make a big difference in that. Let me talk about a few categories of medication that we commonly use. These are prescription, mostly prescription medications. We use diuretics, which are water pills, quite a bit. And I have a lot of ladies who just take them maybe 3 days a month, just when they really feel swollen. Now, I hope that those patients are also watching what they eat. I don't think that being given a water pill is a free-for-all to, abuse what you eat and then think a pill's going to correct it. It's not a healthy mentality. But if you struggle with this every month, you would probably be a lot more comfortable, and you just need to ask your doctor if it's right for you, if it would be okay. There are people who it would not be okay for them to take a water pill. Let me talk about the category of NSAIDs, which is a big fancy word for non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs, which are drugs in the category of aspirin, such as Aleve, Advil, Naprosyn. If anyone here is on Celebrex, that would be in the same family of drugs. These are drugs we all know they would help us if we had a backache, if you had cramps. Let me tell you a little more about them to just make you smarter about them. These drugs chemically interfere with a chemical in our body called prostaglandins that is released. Prostaglandins do all kinds of things for us. We're still learning about them. One of the functions of prostaglandins is they help us have a healthy mucous membrane in our esophagus and our stomach. So the real reason people get ulcers when they take drugs like this is not entirely because the pill sits in their stomach and burns a hole in it, but more because when you take these medicines day after day, they interrupt the ability of the body to promote a healthy environment down there, and then it's easier for erosions and abrasions to occur. So there is some chemical changes that will occur in your body when you take these drugs. These drugs can be hard on your kidneys. So I don't want you to be indiscriminate. But because they interfere with that prostaglandin chain, we know that prostaglandins can make PMS worse. So even if you don't have cramps or backache, I would give them a try and see if you just don't feel better to take a leave for 3 days, 4 days during your cycle and see what happens. Because you may. If you try it and it doesn't make a difference for you, then I would not persist at doing that. Birth control pills, that's BCPs, we use those all the time, especially for young women, but even for women going through perimenopause. They even out your hormones. How does it even out our hormones to give us more hormones? We're already struggling with too many, so why are we going to feel better to take more? Well, one reason is because when we introduce a chemical into our body that our body produces, our body stops producing it because, oh, it's already there. And so they will actually suppress ovulation because we give a regulated amount and the ovaries don't make their own, or they don't make as much. And so we can control the amount of hormones you're having. Many women feel much better if they tend to go more high and more low for us to just control that. Women tend to have lighter periods on birth control pills. Many women won't ovulate at all on them, so you don't get that big surge of progesterone. You just get that nice little bit that's in the pill package at the end of the month. So I think they're a really nice option. Now, they're not without their, complications. There are many women who can't take them if you've had a history of blood clots. some women with migraines, depending on the background of their migraines. If you are at risk for breast cancer, these are not good options for you. So you need to talk to your healthcare provider and find out if you are a candidate for those. But if you, your daughter, someone you know is struggling, I would certainly consider taking them. If you take birth control pills, here's a really good question. Is it the same as taking hormones later? Am I putting myself at risk for breast cancer by taking birth control pills? Well, we've always thought, no, possibly not. But now we think, maybe. So I would just say to you, don't do anything indiscriminately, but there is a place for them. And maybe a temporary evening out of hormones, maybe a year, would make someone feel good enough, and maybe their own hormones would kind of settle down enough that when they came off of them, they would feel better. I want to talk about antidepressants. And isn't that kind of taboo? This is how I feel sometimes, especially in independent fundamental Baptist circles, to talk about taking antidepressant medication. I felt uncomfortable enough about it that I just want you all to know, I sat down with Pastor Phelps, said, you know, okay, you know, I'm giving this talk. You guys asked me to give this talk. So now, what's your honest opinion about antidepressant medication? I use it. I prescribe it all the time. And Pastor Phelps said he considers it a tool, a valuable tool. If you meet criteria to be on that, then you should use the tool that is there for you. So having said that, you know, we don't like to talk about I've been put on an antidepressant medication because I was really struggling with depression with my menstrual cycle. And I wish it wasn't that way. I feel like who better to support ladies than ladies? You know, I have a wonderful husband, but the whole female thing, you know, it's just not there. So I feel like we need each other, and we just need to accept that some of us are going to have problems in different areas than others. And there are some really good medications on the market, especially for PMS. Some of them have been indicated. They're not, and I don't want to give you a whole big lecture on the families and classifications of antidepressant medicines, but let me say this as kind of a blanket statement. This is what I tell patients. Just like there are, maybe this will help you understand, there are families of antibiotics. So you probably all know there's the penicillin family. It has amoxicillin, ampicillin, augmentin. There's the cephalosporin family that has Keflex and C-Clor. There's families of antidepressants, and they fall in chemical categories. But, of course, there's multiple ones in a category, partly for marketing reasons, because companies think, oh, that's a good chemical. We're going to make one so we can make money, too. There are families that are what I call tranquilizing families, families that are anti-anxiety agents, mood-altering agents, anti-hallucinogenics. But there are also families of newer antidepressants that are made that I don't really consider mood-altering. They are based on chemical research that shows that if we can change the serotonin and dopamine levels in our brain that we know lower, just with aging, happens as we age. With stress, if you've had any other kind of chronic illness, they can get low. And these drugs work to elevate them, and they fix the problem for many women. So if you think that you might be interested in that, it is worth talking to your healthcare provider about. And I would just say to you, don't be afraid to do that or ashamed to do that. Natural remedies for PMS hormones. Evening primrose oil, lots of women love it. The research is not real solid on it, I'll just tell you. But I would tell someone it's okay to try it. It's okay to try it. See if it makes you feel better. It's a fatty acid. It's the same as flaxseed, even fish oils, I think, in the fatty acid chain family. Soy, let me tell you about soy. Soy gets a lot of hype. There's a chemical in soy. It's called an isoflavin. Different soy foods have different amounts. So just indiscriminately eating soy does not guarantee that you will get a good amount of that. And that's what they think is beneficial to you. So you might want to read the labels if you're eating soy to try and boost your isoflavin level to try and prevent PMS. And you'd need to do a little research on your own about that. Soy has one caution. There are some people who think it can mimic a hormone in your body and maybe stimulate hormone receptors. So if you have had breast cancer, you probably would not be someone who would want to ingest a lot of soy. But for other women, it's generally considered very safe. Why do women in Asian countries have lower breast cancer to us? Is it all about soy? We don't really think so. There's many variables. They don't eat the beef we do. They don't eat the processed food we do. They walk a lot more. They don't eat the sugar. Have you ever gone to a Chinese restaurant? The dessert's terrible because it's a little tiny cookie and that's it. So, you know, they don't have a big chocolate fudge cake at the end of the buffet bar. And I think that's a part of the reason why they're a little healthier than us. A couple over-the-counter pills, Premsin, Midol, these are combination pills. They have, in fact, they're kind of, to me, funny combinations. They have antihistamine in them, which is like Benadryl, which what's that going to do for you with PMS? All I can figure is it makes you sleepy, so you'll sleep, so take them at night. They have a little mild diuretic, Tylenol. So honestly, if I had my life to live over, I'd probably try them. I didn't ever use them, but That could have helped me probably. Vitamins and supplements, should you use them? We use them all the time in my office. We tell people to take magnesium if they're tired, zinc, calcium, a good multivitamin. We just think on general principle. The research has not actually proven them to really help PMS. But, you know, I just can't escape that a vitamin has to help everybody. So we just recommend them. And, in fact, we recommend supplements of the zinc and magnesium and folate to anyone who seems particularly tired. And we often have people say they feel better. Here's one little nugget to take away from today. The vitamin D. Vitamin D is becoming the big. So if you want to watch or think about, if I was going to pick one thing to be aware of, I would be aware of vitamin D. They think especially the Midwest is deficient because we don't have enough sunny days to meet, and we're all inside all the time. We don't manufacture quite enough on our own. And so the FDA has just doubled the accepted or required amount from 400 international units to 800. So you'll probably see that on start to be recommended, but I've heard people recommend upwards of 2,000 international units recently. Now, we're not doing that yet, but you might want to do your own research on it. They think vitamin D may be helpful in all kinds of health conditions. Of course, lots of things they say that before they've really done the studies on them, but it looks positive, I would say. No, they do not. They're different. They're totally different. You need to think of serotonin as just a chemical in your brain, more for depression. Vitamin D helps us absorb calcium. They think it may be anti-inflammatory. It helps prevent osteoporosis. There's some postulation that it may be like an anti-cancer vitamin. Very different from serotonin. When should you seek help? When this is kind of muddy, you know, all these symptoms, how you feel, what to take, how do you know? Well, if you can't quite figure out your diagnosis, you've done a calendar, just doesn't make sense to you, you've tried some of these things, you're not getting any better, if you have thoughts of suicide at all, if you have an impaired ability to function, you should seek help and not be afraid to do that. What is perimenopause? Perimenopause is just PMS that's gone bad. You know, that's what I think of it. It is a transition into menopause that for most women will last at least 4 years. 4 years. And can last up to 10. And all it is your... I know. All it is your ovaries declining in how much estrogen they put out. So remember our picture... The ovaries are putting out the estrogen until the egg is mature. So let's say that ovary doesn't quite put out as much estrogen, and instead of 14 days, it takes 3 weeks to get that egg to mature. So you've been kind of low for a couple of weeks. That egg finally matures, that follicle ruptures, and now you got this big surge of progesterone and estrogen. So you were really down here, and now you're really up here, plus your period didn't start for 5.5 weeks instead of 4. And that's what can happen, and that's very normal. But it is a time of more wild swings in your estrogen level in particular as it starts to decline. And eventually that level will drop off enough that you won't ovulate at all and you won't have a period. But it takes a while for it to get there. You can have heavier bleeding when you finally do have a period, because you may have had a little longer for that lining to get thick in your uterus before you shed it. You can have lighter periods. Periods can vary by up to 7 days on either side of a 28-day cycle and be considered normal. So you can go from being someone who had a menstrual cycle every 30 days to someone who goes every 22 days, and that's really crummy, but that happens to people all the time. And that would be considered normal. You know, nobody would really get very excited about that. I wanted to tell you one abnormal finding, if this happens to you, that you need to seek attention. Your periods can get quite a bit heavier, but it is not normal to pass lots of large clots. And if you feel that your bleeding seems not right, too heavy, then you need to seek attention. You can develop fibroids during this age. You could even develop, in a worst-case scenario, a uterine cancer. So if you think there's a question about that, especially if you're having very heavy bleeding combined with being very tired, then you need to check it out. Here's one new symptom that will occur during the perimenopausal time. You will develop hot flashes. Most women have night sweats or hot flashes of some nature. And why do we get those? What they think is that the temperature regulation center in the brain, it gets a narrower margin of what's an okay body temperature for you, so that you just don't tolerate any extremes. You will feel more cold when it's cold, and you will be more easily hot when it's hot, and that the body, as it's learning to adjust to this, has an exaggerated response to heat, so that it will, if it feels triggered that you're outside the norm, it will try to cool you down, and you'll dilate your blood vessels, you'll sweat, hot drinks, spicy food, exertion, adrenaline can all trigger this. I had two, they were so cute, which is this little man with his wife in an igloo, and I just like that. This stage of life can be complicated by just the fact that, you know, we're not 20 anymore when you start to go through this. So you really aren't, I don't know how many of you ever pulled an all-nighter when you were young to just get your house in order and maybe cook those final brownies and your in-laws are coming and get the laundry folded. I can't do that now and be okay anymore. And so you have limitations you didn't have when you were young. So let's add that to some of these other symptoms. Maybe you have increased responsibilities. Maybe you're helping take care of parents. Maybe your children are at a very active stage. Maybe you've gone back to work if you weren't, or you're just working still, and that's a big deal. So this can be a hard time to get through, is the perimenopausal time period. What will affect what age you do go through menopause? Well, I want to put smoking on there. I don't imagine necessarily that we have many smokers in this room, but we all have friends and family. And if you smoke, you will go through menopause several years earlier than your counterpart who does not smoke, amongst many other bad things that smoking can do for you. Your family history, there is a genetic correlation between when your mother went through menopause and when you will. If you've never had a baby, if you've had chemo or radiation to your pelvis, if you had a hysterectomy but they left your ovaries in, you need to know they cut the main artery to your ovaries when they cut your uterus out. So they shriveled up and quit producing as much hormone immediately, so you will go through an earlier menopause. You know, you've not had quite the same level of hormones as someone who didn't have their uterus removed. So what can you do? What can you do about it? Well, when you start to go through this, if you haven't got a grip on a few things in your life, now is the time, girls, to just start to be disciplined, to get enough rest. They no longer think 8 hours is enough. They now say we all need 9, and some people more. So there's a new okay number for sleep, and it's 9 hours. They also say you need a regular bedtime and a regular getting up time, because we know the rhythms in our body play more importance than we used to think, and your body needs to be in a rhythm to be the healthiest you can be. So if you're one of those people who goes to bed at 8 tonight so you can stay up till 1 tomorrow, it's not good for you. Don't smoke. I've already said that, but I just really, that's a big deal to me that people don't smoke. If you go home and your neighbor's smoking and she's talking about her PMS, you can say, I just went to this workshop and she really harped on don't smoke. Find healthy ways to cope with stress. This is my favorite way to cope with stress, would be to sit down with a book and just live in that world for a while. But whatever is your favorite way to cope with stress, find it so you can do it. And when you feel like you need to do that, give yourself permission to take care of your stress. Exercise. Not talking about athletic training. I'm talking about just getting moving. If that just means, for some people, that means a walk in the fresh air. Get some sunshine. I'm a big believer, if you can't get out, do an exercise video in your house. That's easy. And convenient. Same dietary principles, although in my opinion they get even more important, because they can have other implications as we start to go through menopause regarding heart disease, diabetes, things like that. Caffeine needs to only be used in moderation. It really does. So if you abused it in your 20s and 30s, now is the time to probably take a good look at it. I don't think we need to cut it out, But it just needs to be in moderation. I think sugary foods need to, and I love my sweets, but they need to go out the window. And salty food. So here's a big, big question. Should you take hormones? Boy, what's the rates of breast cancer right now in our country? Does anybody know? 1 in 8. That's if you do nothing, you know, if you're just walking down the street, 1 in every 8 women has the potential to get breast cancer. It's huge right now. If you take hormones, are you at more risk of getting breast cancer? Right now, we think slightly. Slightly in your mind might be a big fat yes. Slightly in someone else's mind might be maybe not. So it becomes a personal decision. Here's what I tell women. I know people who used to, 15 years ago, 20 years ago, put everybody on hormones because they thought they prevented osteoporosis, maybe prevented heart disease. We're wiser now. We don't do that. But if you feel, and I have women having 50 hot flashes a day. I mean, that's, you can't go to work in an office, and especially with men, and be like that. It doesn't work. So I think there is a place for hormone therapy in women today. It just needs to be used with caution. You need to do it under medical direction. And many women feel much better to take a short course of hormones. Here's what I would like. There's lots of hormone choices. There's bioavailable, there's natural hormones, there's just plain old Premarin. We have all heard of that. There's patches. There's lots of choices out there for you. There's like the PremPro, which is kind of like a birth control pill. If I could tell you to go home with a couple nuggets about hormone replacement therapy, this is what I would want you to go home and know, that yes, you can slightly increase your risk for breast cancer if you take it, but that there is a place for many women to use hormone replacement therapy, and that it's just a personal decision for you to make with your provider. But this is what I don't want anyone to think, I don't want anyone to do, to have an indiscriminate use of hormones. I can't tell you. I just had a lady Thursday, 69 years old, has been on hormone replacement therapy for 15 years. I said, well, has anyone talked to you about cutting back on your hormones? No, never had a conversation about that. They think that the length of time you take hormones is as important as taking the hormones because you become increasingly at risk over a period of time. So if you commit to take hormone replacement therapy, in your mind, say, I'm going to try this for maybe 2 years, and then I'm going to try to come off and see how I feel. And then if I'm not quite ready, you know, I might take it another year, and maybe every year I'll see if I can wean down my hormones and come off. Maybe you'll take them for 5 years if you're younger. But none of this, I'll take them till somebody tells me not to. You know, be on top of your own health care and limit how long you take your hormones. That would be, I think, the most important thing to me. Many women cannot take them. If you have a first-degree relative with breast cancer, you shouldn't go anywhere near them, in my opinion. Here's something that I think is probably one of the most effective over-the-counter remedies that we use, is black cohosh. It is sold in a product called Estrovin. Estrovin is made, you know, there's Estrovin Maximum Strength. There's all a bunch of them out there. Black cohosh has been proven through scientific studies to help predominantly with hot flashes. So if that is one of your main symptoms, it really does help with that. And it's an herbal remedy. They're still trying to figure out exactly how it works. There is some thought that it works kind of like a hormone. Could it stimulate hormone receptors in someone who's at risk for breast cancer? Maybe. They're still studying that. Maybe not. So I would use it if I was struggling and would try it and just see if you like it. So what is menopause? We know about perimenopause. We know about PMS. Menopause is you have your last period. You go 12 months without a single period. Then you can go back to the date of your last period and say that was the date I went through menopause. 12 months. So when you've gone 12 months, what if you go 7 months without a period? Here's the big million-dollar question. Could you get pregnant? Yes, you could. because you could ovulate an egg if you have a period. You know, that tells me you're still ovulating and you could have a baby. So if you don't want to have a baby at 51 and you have not gone 12 months without having a period, you need to think about that. Here's my postmenopausal lady, because menopause is considered a second youth for most women. Menopause is natural because your hormones even out. Many women actually feel significantly better when they hit that point. They have renewed energy. They don't have the hormone fluctuations. They don't have to mess with their menstrual cycle anymore. And it's a wonderful time for them of kind of new beginnings. And I can attest to that. Here's one of my favorite quotes from Elizabeth George, and I like her books. I don't know if you've read her books. This is from her book, Life Management for Busy Women. When your output exceeds your input, then your upkeep will be your downfall. That's just kind of fun. I just wanted to say that today. So I put that in there. But, you know, I just want to say again, and I'm kind of there, if you are 49, 50, in that whole age range, I think it's a very busy age. You know, I just think so much responsibility I feel like I have with parents, kids, my house, my job. And I think we can really, so easy to overextend, so easy. So we have to be careful of that. And sometimes I think we blame things on menopause and hormones that are really us overdoing it as women. You know, the whole, I think about the women of Israel who had to go to the tent or had to, you know, be sequestered. And sometimes I think that was a kindness from God because they rested and they didn't have all the responsibilities that we just carry on like nothing's happened in the middle of feeling all of this. Here's my illustration to help you know what to do about for yourself. If this is how you feel, I love the illustration of a wheel and spokes. If you feel like your wheel is not rolling with your health, then I would say encourage you to think of one thing that you know. You can probably think of one thing that you know you need to do that would be a healthy behavior. So let's put one good spoke on the wheel. I don't know what it is for you. Maybe it's going to bed at the same time every night. And just see what happens. If one good spoke, I'd give it a couple months, isn't enough, put a couple spokes on the wheel and keep adding in healthy behaviors to help yourself feel better. Some of you need a lot of spokes on your wheel, and you need to overhaul your diet, your sleep, the stress in your life. Maybe you need to take some medication. Maybe you need to seek some medical attention. Maybe you need blood work done to check your thyroid level. So maybe you need a good physical exam. Now's a good time to get a good physical as you're going through all these changes. What does the Bible say to us about our health as women? Well, I couldn't find anything that was really women-oriented, but you know what I did find? Whoops. I found a verse that says it's okay to pray for good health. 3 John 1:2, "Beloved, I wish above all things that thou mayest prosper and be in health, even as thy soul prospereth." I think it's okay to pray and ask God for good health. But then I think we need to do our part about that. God may or may not solve all of your health problems. I don't know what his will is for you. I like this verse, 2 Corinthians 12:9, "And he said unto me, my grace is sufficient for thee, for my strength is made perfect in weakness. Most gladly, therefore, will I rather glory in my infirmities, that the power of Christ may rest upon me." If you are struggling with some health problems and you and God does not remove them and heal you from them, God can still be glorified in your life. And you can be a testimony to others of how you handle what you're going through. I think one way to do that is to constantly pray that we will walk in the Spirit so that we do not fulfill the lusts of the flesh. That's just a good challenge to any believer. I gave you a paper today that has Bible verses on it. I feel like, you know, it's kind of like breast tissue. There's two kinds of us, and some of us are a mix. There are the people who know what you need to do, and you're not taking good care of yourself. And so you need motivated, and maybe reading what God's word has to say about, you know, fight the fight, dig in there, you need to take care of yourself, are the verses you need. maybe you feel like you're doing everything and you're just kind of down and discouraged about it. Maybe you feel depressed and lonely. So on the other side of the paper are verses for you about how much God cares about you and that God is with you even through your problems. And if you're a mix, read verses from both sides. I want to thank each one of you for coming today, and I hope that that was a blessing to you.